Hello and welcome to Chats, a television podcast, Season 7, Prisoner Chats. Now, I would tell you that I'm recording from New York, but that's not possible. There is no New York, only the Village. My name is Magellan, and in their mind, in their soul, Alan knows that Alan is Alan. It's Alan.
Hi, wow, hello.
Hey, I have more.
Okay, keep going.
My name is Magellan, and the louder a man shouts, the more profoundly they're wrong. It's Alan.
Hey guys, hello, welcome.
No, sorry, I got more. Okay. My name is Magellan, and two brought me here to love them. Two brought me here to break their heart. It's Alan.
Oh, hey everyone, welcome. Hey, welcome.
I do have three more.
Oh God.
So I'm just going to do them. Yeah. My name is Magellan, and my dear co-host, it is a trap. You have such a high opinion of yourself. I was wondering if you'd be smart enough to turn this opportunity to your own advantage. It's Alan. Hmm. My name is Magellan, and every bit of pain I know is because of them. It's Alan. My name is Magellan, and they're in love with their own humanity. They only want to do the right thing, and that is what will give them to me. It's Alan. Okay, I'm done now.
Hello. Hi. Thank you for giving me six bespoke introductions on this episode of Chats.
Because six, right? Number six.
Oh my God, is that why it's six episodes?
Maybe.
Stop.
Did you notice in the logo there's a six in the O?
No. Send me the logo.
How? Just look it up. Look up Prisoner 2009 logo. There's a six in the O.
Oh, this shit.
This is a show where we...
In the
yeah,
O.
Yeah, cool, right? That's kind of cute. Anyway, this is a show where we watch The Prisoner, and you might be saying, you all finished The Prisoner last week.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. That shot of Angela Mascott, that was great.
Yeah, that was the last shot, and then there were more, but that was the last important shot, except for the one that's a redo of the shot from the very beginning of the show, which is perhaps the most important shot, but whatever. You might be saying it's done.
It's not done.
But it's not done, at least not according to AMC, American Movie Channel.
Is it American Movie Classics?
Afternoons with Mom on the Couch, AMC.
Oh, my cat.
Is it American Movie Classics? Because there's Turner Classic Movies.
It's American Movie Classics.
Jesus. Jesus.
I'm sorry.
Anyway, AMC in 2009 decided that they were going to do it all over again. They were going to bring that prisoner back. They're going to put number six back in the village, mm-hmm. and say, you're stuck there again, buddy. Make us some more content. And so they did a six episode reboot of The Prisoner.
Fascinating.
And that's what we watched for this week. And yeah, Alan, before we talk about that, how are you?
I'm really well. Thank you for asking. I just ate a banana, and the shell is looking at me right now, judgingly, being like, "You better be a good podcaster." And frankly, I won't let it stand.
You're gonna get that slow drip of banana energy, which is gonna be prime.
Oh yeah, banana energy. By halfway through this, I might actually come to like The Prisoner 09.
You'll just be so pumped that you can't help it.
Full of potassium.
Oh,
no,
boy.
I'm good. I'm getting a little antsy because I'm like, I got to do something today. I got that productivity bug, but you know,
that's what podcasting is for.
I had some avocado toast this morning, so I'm trying to eat. I'm trying to eat good. We eating good, man.
Yeah.
What about you?
Yeah, I'm doing all right. It's Memorial Day weekend when we're recording this. We're a little ahead of schedule, and I'm luxuriating in a 4-day weekend, which you would think wouldn't feel different from all the other time I spend at home. But when you remove that expectation that I'm at work, it really opens the day up and makes it good. I went for a long hour and a half walk yesterday.
Ugh.
Just a lengthy, lengthy walk. It was beautiful. And then, I've been eating salads.
I saw. You sent me a picture of your salad.
3 days in a row I've had a salad, which is very big for me.
What protein are you rocking in the salad?
Got some chickpeas.
Yum.
Does edamame have protein?
I think so.
It's in there. Does spinach have protein?
It has to.
I don't know. But that's what it's the salad is. It's spinach, shredded red cabbage, edamame, mm-hmm. Chickpeas, feta cheese, and then, you know, a nice garden vegetable vinaigrette is what goes on top of that. It's a fine salad. It's got some chunks.
It's got some yunks.
Sort of our free floating chunks, yeah. And I've been enjoying that as a sort of way to get me to eat that instead of something that's less good for me.
I dig it. Yeah, I was looking up edamame, and A, it does have protein in it, and B, the top like 8 Google searches for edamame. Is edamame considered a protein or a carb? This is a poem, by the way. I've written this poem.
Okay, thank you.
Is edamame a healthy snack? Does edamame give you gas? Can I eat edamame every single day? Why is edamame not good for you? What happens if I eat too much edamame? I just like to think that some of those, like the progressing anxiety of like, what happens if I replaced my entire diet with edamame by accident? I bought like 50,000 pounds of edamame. What do I do?
That's funny. I kind of want to steal that bit. In college, I was in a sketch show where I did a spoken word poem that was just all of the subject lines of emails that I got that ended or included EOM. Because people would say, do you know that?
No.
EOM stands for end of message. Oh. So it's whenever people would send an email to the whatever dorm emails or whatever emails I was on, and the subject line was the whole message, mm-hmm. and it'd be things like, does anybody have a shovel, EOM, or things like that. And so I put it into a poem, and it had a very similar energy to that edamame.
Love it.
I just read.
That's awesome.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about The Prisoner. How about that?
Let's talk about The Prisoner, parentheses, 2009.
Great. You can assume from this point forward, well, no, because we'll probably be referencing the original Prisoner. It'll be clear. We'll make it clear.
My first thing I wanted to bring up, though, was just that it's kind of fun that we might very well be the only podcast talking about The Prisoner 2009.
You think so? You think there's not been another Prisoner podcast that was like, all right, well, I guess we have to.
Well, first of all, I don't know. That's true. I don't even know how many Prisoner podcasts, how many there are, and how many of them are going to cover the 09 one as in-depth as we are. I mean, we mentioned last week we are going to be discussing all 6 episodes, spoilers included, so we're not going to be digging into like the plot of each one, but definitely the reveals and the overall, like our thoughts on it as a remake and as a even as an independent work, I think.
Yeah. I found one podcast that has an episode titled The Prisoner 2009 Part 1, and then there are no episodes after Ooh. That, and that was 5 years ago. So I think
it slayed them. That's so sad.
They were like, never mind. There's this other one that specifies that it's a podcast guide to Patrick McGoohan's Prisoner specifically. Anyway, so let's get into 2009 Prisoner here. In terms of production notes, all 6 episodes were written by Bill Gallagher and directed by Nick Hurren. The miniseries aired 2 episodes a night, 3 nights in a row from November 15th to November 17th of 2009. So it was a television event.
Hmm.
Event television in the fall. Kind of a weird spot, I guess.
It's The Prisoner 2009. It's a primarily British production crew. And we've got our boy, Jim Caviezel, as number 6, or mm-hmm. Michael, as we learn in episode 5, which is one of many cardinal sins that this remake
One
commits.
Of the cinema sins that they commit.
I don't want any of this to sound like a cinema sins, but there's a lot of sins that this remake commits. Our number 2, we have one number 2 this time, and his mm-hmm. name is Curtis. He's played by Ian McKellen. And the two main other cast members are Ruth Wilson as number 313 and Haley Atwell as number 415. Oh, I guess also, what's his face? Jamie Campbell Bauer as 1112 is pretty important by the end of the series as number
and then,
2.
Yeah, and then there's number 2's wife who goes by M2 mm-hmm. for some reason. And then another side character who you think is going to be more than he is, Lenny James as number 147. And we'll kind of break down who all those people are. I think first off, we can give sort of a general overview of just what the episodes were about.
Yeah.
Like I can just kind of run through a summary for folks either who have not seen it in a while or if you don't feel like watching it.
I wouldn't blame you.
Yeah, we can tell you what it's about and then basically give you our thoughts. What's the headline for you, by the way? Did you like it?
The headline of like the overall thing.
Yeah. Did you like it? Did you not like it?
I appreciate its existence. I respect its existence. Overall, I didn't like it.
Yeah. I think I actually enjoyed watching it. I don't think it's great. And it definitely shouldn't be called The Prisoner.
That's the thing.
It should be a different show that is like doing homage to The Prisoner. Mm-hmm. But like it's just so different. I don't know. Yeah, so I can run through the six episodes of the show. Each one is titled in some way after one of the original episodes of The Prisoner, the Patrick McGoohan series. So the first episode is Arrival, where basically Jim Caviezel wakes up in a desert and he's like, oh my God, I'm in a desert. And it's the village. And then he gets driven into the village. He's looking for people to try to give him answers to what's going on. And then it really just sets the tone. I don't remember anything super specific from episode one. There's not like a gimmick to it. Episode two is called Harmony. And the whole gist of Harmony is that number two is basically trying to convince Six that this one dude is his brother. And his brother has like a great family and they hang out and drive buses together. And the whole time Six is like, you're not my brother. And then he eventually says, oh, maybe you are my brother. And the guy's like, dude, no, I'm not your brother. Actually, we're all trapped here. The third episode is Anvil, which is Six is assigned to be essentially like a private detective with this other guy. And they sort of go around and spy on villagers together. And Six just does it because it's not clear, but he's sort of like, yeah, all right, I guess so. Kind of, I guess, because he wants to be the guy who watches the people who watch people. Mm-hmm. And then we can get into more from that episode later. Episode four is called Darling. And throughout the entire show up to this point, seemingly number six has been having flashbacks to when he was in New York. And all of the flashbacks center around conversations that he has with Haley Atwell's character. And it's sort of like, ooh, this sexy lady was talking to me in a bar, and now we're at my house drinking beers. There's like a line where he's like, maybe I like to forget things by drinking beers.
Stop drinking those beers. I'm going to drink more beers.
Yeah, they literally say that. So there are a bunch of flashbacks to him talking to her. And then in the episode Darling, she shows up in the village, seemingly having lost any memory of being in New York. And then Six is undergoes treatment to like make him fall in love with her. And then the episode ends with her committing suicide, of course. Episode five is called Schizoid. And in that episode, Six somehow has like a personality split where he splits into two sixes. And one of them is like unbridled id, like trying to fuck people, but also trying to kill number two. And number two splits into two people. One of them is a sort of like super chill cigarette smoking guy who's like, yeah, whatever. And then the other one is like normal number two. And then episode six, Checkmate, is where the series is like, okay, you want to know what's going on? We'll tell you what's going on. And essentially what is revealed is that Jim Caviezel's character had been working for this mega corporation called SumaCore. And he was like, it's so not clear what SumaCore does, but at least what they tell us is that it's a surveillance company or something. Mm-hmm. And Jim Caviezel's part of his job is to like watch people.
He's like collecting data and through surveillance on people, trying to determine who's like a problem and needs to be, you know, maybe adjusted in some way out of society.
Right. And so then it's revealed that like the mechanism by which to adjust people is putting them in the village. And the village is like is basically a level of consciousness that is created and maintained by number two's wife being essentially in like a drug-induced coma state. Mm-hmm. It's not clear where people's bodies are while they're in the village, because you find out that the flashbacks actually maybe were happening concurrently with the village stuff.
Yeah.
And so that's not 100% clear. But the idea is that the village is this like psychological sci-fi construct to acclimate people to be good, moral, assimilated citizens. And then number two's like master stroke is after, we'll talk about his son, but he has a son. His son finds out that he only exists in the village and is so upset by that that he suffocates his own mother to death, in theory, but she's still alive.
Because all that does is it breaks the simulation, right?
Right. It just breaks her ability to maintain the thing, I guess. And so then number two needs somebody else to do it. So he convinces Ruth Wilson's character, 313, to... He's going to get number six to do it. Like, here, take the pills. You're going to save all these people. But then 313 does it. And then six is like trapped in the village forever. Ian McKellen is free. He blows his head off with a grenade.
Oh.
And then it ends on a shot of number six being like, oh, yeah, we can remake the village, right? Yeah, totally. We can make a great village. And Ruth Wilson is just catatonic, like leaning against him. They're both looking out at the sunset. And that's the prisoner. And it's over. Yeah.
Yeah.
So some differences from the original. I guess we can start with like what stuck out to you as like cool. What stuck out to you as maybe changed for the worse or frustrating? Yeah. Highlight, low light. Things that you think they missed from the original that they could have brought in?
Yeah, these are good questions. It's first of all, it's just really fun watching a show from 2009, because especially an AMC series, because at the time, the shows at least that I remember blowing up were Breaking Bad and Mad Men were like hitting their stride at this point.
Yeah.
And I was like...
Mad Men started in 07. I looked it up. And then...
didn't Breaking Bad also start in 07?
I can look that up while you're talking.
But yeah, point is they were both like... reaching a critical mass.
Breaking Bad was 08.
Oh, wait, so. Yeah. So they're both pretty big at this point. And you really see a house style sort of form in the like way that modern prestige drama.
Yeah.
Especially like modern cable. Like these don't, this doesn't look like an HBO show. It looks like an AMC show. And
yeah.
It was so weird for my brain to adjust to like, oh my God, like everything I watched in high school looked like this. Like all of these, like The Walking Dead looks like this. And this show looks like this. And Breaking Bad and Mad Men, like... what? And it's hard to describe. It's, I mean, it's a lot of like really tight close-ups and a lot of, and just like the way the camera looks, the way people are framed mostly. It's a very like clean look, borderline like sterile, which mostly works for the prisoner, except for the fact that they changed the setting. And, you know, I don't want to just poo-poo on this, so I'll say one of the things I appreciate is that they changed the setting. I think it serves a purpose that it's in the desert. The show was shot primarily in Namibia, which is pretty cool that they were able to shoot on location, because there's all these like desert scenes and stuff that they actually were able to film there. And it being in a desert makes a little bit more sense than it being on a deserted island that actually can be driven off of with a fun truck. Like, it's a little bit more grounded, actually, than Prisoner 67. But
yeah, right.
That also means that they have to spend a lot of time explaining, like, okay, where are we? And, like, what does this mean? And all this stuff. And, you know, it being in 09 on one hand makes it feel modern and fresh, but also puts it in that same time frame as, like, the burgeoning mystery show drama of the tens and 20 in aughts, your Losts, your Fringe, your, you
right.
Know,
it felt very Losty.
So
I mean, I haven't seen, I've only ever seen the first episode of Lost, much
but
to
it looks
Alan's
like that.
Frustration.
Yes.
But it, I've heard Lost talked about enough that like, this sort of intentional obfuscation of what's going on and like, ooh, we're going to jitter the camera now because this is supposed to be confusing. And like, we're going to flash back and flash forward and show their real life and show their island life or whatever. Mm-hmm. That all, it feels like it's borrowing a lot from from Lost specifically, and then yeah, stylistically, the look, it, if Mad Men was set in a desert, it would look like this.
Exactly.
And it does look a lot like Breaking Bad sometimes.
Yeah, it's, and that's the problem. That's one of the things that's frustrating as a Lost fan, is that so many shows attempted to do that, and this show commits the same, like, has the same problem that all of those do, which is they forgot to make the characters likable, or just didn't have the time. I think forgot is kind of an unfair thing to say, but it cares more about the mystery and about the tone than right. It does about, like, why should I care about any of this? It just throws ideas and words and speeches at you, and you're like, none of this is registering as, like, interesting or characterful for me at all.
Yeah, it feels, I think, a principal difference in terms of, like, the goals of the shows is that Patrick McGoohan set out to create an allegorical show where, like, things, symbols, people, characters corresponded to things in the real world. And this show does not feel at all allegorical. Like, it's not, it's not trying to do that. It's trying to tell a sci-fi story in a specific setting with plot and answers. And so all of the characters are defined pretty much exclusively through, like, the things that happen to them, instead of, like, fundamentally who they are or what they represent. Like, if you were to ask me to describe Ruth Wilson's character, like, who she is, I don't think that I could give you adjectives.
Yeah.
And same with Jim Caviezel's number six. I don't think I could give you adjectives. He's suspicious, I guess, of things. But more so, I can describe him in terms of, like, the things that happen to him.
Yeah.
And that makes this feel, with the cinematography, adds to this, like, sterile feeling of the show.
Mm-hmm. It's a very, like, set up all these mysteries and then we'll answer them all at once in a sweeping rush at the end kind of show.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, I'm a sucker for that kind of thing. That was, like, the original thing that got me excited about Lost, was, like, I like questions and answers. I don't want to say this as if, like, I hate that and I think that's a bad idea. There's plenty of merit to that, but it really has to come with some sort of character, with some sort of personality, or in the case of The Prisoner, just give me allegory. Like, tell me that this is actually mapped to something in the real world, or let me answer that question for myself. Because that's more satisfying to me, and I come out of it thinking more. Instead of this, where I just finish it and I'm like, damn, that final shot is goofy as hell. And that's all I got.
Yeah. And, I think in terms of where, I think there are some changes or shifts in the show that make sense for the modern context that could function and aren't fully realized or successful. But you were talking about the setting, and not only is the village transplanted to a desert, but the sort of look and feel of the village is totally different too, because in the original, it's this idyllic island resort that is meant to kind of, it's meant to show, like, oh, it really actually made me think about what the point of the village being this beautiful Technicolor place is meant to do. And I think actually in the original, the point of everything being so flashy is to say, like, hey, 60s people, even though you feel like you're living in this kind of vibrant, aesthetically rebellious period of time, that could be part of the artifice of, like, society's actually not that different, right? And you're just sort of content with everything is, like, cool looking and groovy and mod now. But in actuality, that's just a form of conformity. And I think that that's actually, like, a hidden subtext of the original Prisoner. Also, the fact that things are so vibrant was unsettling at that time, I think.
Yeah.
In ways where if you did that in 2009, to viewers in 2009, that wouldn't be a particularly unsettling aesthetic. And so what they do instead is the village is this very monotone grays and whites suburb.
Yeah.
And so it's making commentary about, like, suburban life and complacency. So really the whole show, instead of being this sort of, like, we have to be individuals in the face of fascism, it's like we have to be individuals in the face of corporate, suburban, capitalist complacency America. But also, it is a TV show that functions like any TV show that serves to uphold that complacency, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like, you almost are saying something. And then it'll do things like, there's this running gag. I was wondering if you thought that was this was funny. This running gag that the only food in the village is wraps.
Oh, my God. I did think it was funny, especially because it looped back around at the end. That's why I liked it.
Yeah.
Because number two's wife at the end is like when we're back into the real world or whatever, whatever is the real world, is like, oh, my God, I just spent the time making wraps. You brought me my favorite food, wraps. It's like,
yeah.
What?
And that's the kind of thing that has like just a little bit of spice to it, a little bit of like there's something in that show. And you didn't really make that show. You had the one idea for the wraps joke and you did it a few times. And so it's not, there's not really any biting commentary in this show, you know? And the thing about the original is it's so, so acerbic and so like trying to do takedowns of the electoral system and college and like, here we go, guns blazing. Hide your institutions because we're coming for them.
Yeah.
And this show just, it feels like defanged to a certain extent. Like it's not really trying to shake people loose of anything.
Yeah. Now, I think one of the images that was really prevalent in the marketing of this that kind of like lines up with what you're talking about, where they defanged the show, is the new Rover. I think it's a really like singular, sort of symbol of what's like frustrating about this new prisoner. Is the Rover in the original series is like person sized. It looks very practical and it also looks unrealistic. Like it's not CG, but they clearly made something into the Rover. And its presence is both comedic and scary at the same time. Like it's scary because it's comedic. I think that's what works best about the Rover. The thing with the Rover in The Prisoner 09 is it's like four times as big. It makes the same noise. So every once in a while, the show will remind you like, hey, I'm watching something like The Prisoner. Like the Rover's here. Okay. But it doesn't have that like weird, unsettling comedy to it because it's just a like overwhelming death machine. It's one of those like you guys have all the tools and all the imagery and you're using them weirdly or incorrectly, I feel like.
Yeah. The show's just not funny at all.
That's the biggest complaint, right?
The raps thing is funny.
Yep.
Sometimes. There are some other moments that are kind of funny.
Yep.
But like comedy was so central to the 60s Prisoner and just this feeling of like, this is absurd.
Yeah.
What the heck? And this show, it doesn't feel silly at all. It feels very self-serious. And then none of the stuff that pops up by this point in TV history, even like, I don't know, the episode where, oh no, I've split into two dudes and one's evil and one's good is like, sure, I've seen versions of that a bajillion times.
Yeah.
You know, so there's like nothing fresh here. It's not.
Redoing The Prisoner now doesn't work.
Right.
And the ways that they try to change it don't feel as fanged as the original do. It's kind of toothless, like you were saying.
Yeah.
Because missing the humor and not trying to adapt the humor and instead like weirdly attempting to adapt the original plot lines in these like condensed and more serious formats just robs them of any meaning. Like, I think that the doppelganger episode is pretty egregious where it's just like, you guys understood. And clearly somebody in the writer's room was like, you know, making number two also be a doppelganger is a cool touch. I agree. I think that's actually like an interesting way to change it.
Yeah, those were the coolest parts of that episode, I think.
But, you know, it ends up feeling really messy because it's trying to do the old thing and this new thing about, like, Six needs to know that he might need to kill number two. And also, the episode six, like, robs all of that character development from the show because it's like, well, this was all in a closed loop anyways, so, you know, why does it matter what Six wants to do or why he wants to get off if he knows that he's just going to be on this island ruling it anyways? Like, and then the romance stuff, I think this is one of the other like under-discussed aspects of New Prisoner, is that we spend a remarkable amount of time in episodes 1 through 4 at least seeming as if like Six is going to have to choose between Hayley Atwell's character and Ruth Wilson's character.
Yeah, and they don't really. It's weird because they like set up that Ruth Wilson's character is maybe the love interest in episodes 1 and 2. It feels like. Yeah. And then the Hayley Atwell flashbacks are just like flashbacks to this lady who you don't expect to see again. Mm-hmm. And then in episode 3, Ruth Wilson is like, get away from me. Like, don't talk to me. I don't want anything to do with you. Okay. That's something. And then in episode 4, it really is all about that love triangle in Darling, which, yeah, it's strange. I mean, I think Darling was my favorite of the 6 episodes, not to be that guy, but I think that I'm that guy. But part of the reason that I liked that episode is because it felt like it was trying to address the fact that the love story felt really tacked on and false. But then the rest of the show keeps doing it. And the rest of the show keeps making Six and Ruth Wilson's character like a will they, won't they thing.
And it's like, who cares?
Yeah. But I did think that, you know, it attempted to address the question of like, what if number 6 was horny?
Yeah.
Which Patrick McGoohan would have never addressed in his show. And I did like in Darling how it starts with, he like comes in to record a video, like a dating video, yeah, type thing. Mm-hmm. Because it's an example of like, if this show is an allegory for like, what are all the, or a exploration of all the ways that in modern society we're made to be complacent. One of the big ways is the sort of like, did you know, gotta find my soulmate, gotta date, gotta find the right person, gotta
be on
go
the dating
on
hustle
apps.
Gotta get on the apps, yeah,
right.
Yep.
That just like dominates so many people's young adult life. And so I think that that actually is, could have been an interesting critique, because then all of his feelings for her are like chemically created, and then Ruth Wilson's character, you know, number 2 is sort of like whispering in her ear and has scenes of like, well, is it possible to undo the thing? Well, just so we both know. Like, yeah, now you know. And, you know, then it ends with her, with Ruth Wilson, like kissing Six on his wedding day and like ruining it. It's really, that's stupid. But then when number 2's like, huh, and I guess you'll never know if your feelings are even real. Anyway, that was pretty cool. But then 4:15 like jumps in a hole and kills herself.
Oh my god! I mean, so that's
and then
go ahead.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
No, and then it goes back to like, I don't know, will they, won't they stuff between 6 and 3:13. So it just felt like the show was both trying to do the love interest thing and also trying to subvert it in ways where it wasn't clear all the time which it was doing.
Mm-hmm. What I was going to say briefly was, this era of show, they often like don't do comedy that well, or will do it in like really absurdist moments. Like we were talking on another podcast about the like Mad Men lawnmower scene is a classic example of how you can do comedy in this sort of like serious grim drama and have it be like absurd and weird and funny.
Mm-hmm.
But this show is as unintentionally funny in a couple times, which bummed me out. Like the one that I kept thinking of was in the episode where the other character, the sort of number 147, were in his house. And there's the first sinkhole outside is opening up. There's like all these sinkholes around the village because it's supposed to be like number 2's wife's mind is like, she's slipping out of the coma. So there are holes into oblivion, which is kind of a cool idea. And they leave the door open and his daughter drives her like fucking tricycle into it. And there's just this moment where she goes, "Wee!" And she falls into the fucking sinkhole of death. And I was like screaming, laughing, and I'm like, this wasn't supposed to be that funny, or as funny as I'm making it out to be.
Yeah, his whole character, it
such a missed opportunity, man.
They don't give him anything to do. So a central thing of this show is clearly saying, hey, all of these people are prisoners.
Yes.
Which is not the case in the original. Mm-hmm. And I think we even talked in previous episodes about, like, what could a show like that look like? What are the things you could do? And it's interesting. I think you could explore that more. I think in 6 episodes, you can't do much with that. But they essentially do nothing with it. Like, he doesn't do anything.
I just think that common, like, newer type of subplot writing is to have a B character who almost never interacts with the main character live out their own storyline. I love that shit. I love it when The Leftovers did that. Lost does that plenty. Like, plenty of shows do that really well. The Expanse is based on that concept, is that there are, like, concurrent stories happening that never intersect with each
Game
other.
Game of Thrones.
Yeah, right. Game of Thrones, exactly. Every chapter is a different perspective in the books and in the show. So I was like, wait, 147's adventures, like, with his wife and child, where he's, like, a little bit more settled. Very cool idea for a B plot of the series. But again, it just ends up being them getting really sad that their daughter fell into a hole and he thinks about jumping into it. And there's a moment of, again, unintentional clarity there where number 6 is like, you know, that hole doesn't go anywhere. You're not getting your daughter back. It sounds like instead of wanting to rescue your daughter, you just want to be dead with your daughter. And, like, you understand that that's oblivion and you just want to climb into it. But there's people in your life that want to talk to you and, like, be with you still.
Yeah.
And you can learn more from her death and use that to, like, progress in life. I thought that was, like, a touching moment that you could even, if the show was a little bit more self-aware, you used to talk about, like, gruff guy protagonists who are, like, going on revenge quests. And it's like, do you just want to die? Is that why you want to, like, kill all the bad guys? Is that why you want to jump into the hole that is revenge? Yeah. Or do you just want, or do you, like, have to accept that there's a life for you outside of the hole?
Right.
And that's all there, but it's all so deeply subtextual that I'm, like, finding stuff that's interesting about the show and it's not. And none of it's in the text.
Agreed. Yeah, I there wasn't really a lot to him. Also, it is upsetting that the one main black character drives the taxi cab and takes him to a medicine man in the last episode. Just going to say that.
I thought they would subvert that the first person he meets is him driving the taxi, and it's like, nope, he's just the driver. Yep. We're not gonna play with that. You could. You guys knew better. It's fine.
Yeah, that could have been number 2.
That could have been number 2. That's right. A good point.
But not the case. Let's talk about number 2 and his son, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Those are the characters we haven't touched on. So Ian McKellen is number 2.
He's too good for this show.
Ian McKellen is perhaps, quite possibly, the best actor ever.
Whoa.
Tell me someone who you have seen more consistently turn nothing into the most nuanced, incredible performance you've ever seen.
I just don't know if that makes someone a better actor than someone else, but he's definitely the best, like, alchemist, like, bad to good actor. Yes, I agree with that.
Well, but I think that's the work of acting, like, finding and creating something out of the words on the page.
Okay.
And he could do that with anything.
That's fair. I can't think of anything off the top of my head, so I'm not going to dispute that, but it's just I was surprised by the superlativeness of it. But he's incredible. It's, like, really unfair. I could watch him in his crispy white suit talk about, fate and free will all day long, man.
Right.
And, like, talk to his son about family and be like, yeah, people defend their family even when they know they're wrong. And that stuff is fantastic. I really, him though, his whole thing, I really just wished they borrowed more from the fashion of the prisoner. Because that's the other thing is they don't have, like, uniforms in this show, really. Like, the cops, the police just kind of look like vaguely, like, you know, police, like secret police. And all of the higher-ups wear, like, cream-colored suits, mostly, or, like, off-white colored suits. And everyone else just wears normal clothes. 6 has, like, multiple outfit changes, and they're all boring. Like, that's...
Right, yeah. I think that's sort of the downside of doing this, like, beiged-out thing is... You're making a surface level commentary about, like, complacency and suburbia and corporate America or whatever. But by doing it that way, you're making your show look way more boring. So
right.
Boring to look at. Yeah.
Yeah.
But there's just some moments that Ian McKellen has that are, like, masterclass. scenes.
For sure.
Like in the first episode when he goes, there's this whole thing in the first episode where Six is going to therapy, or maybe that's the second one actually.
I don't remember.
I think it's the second one actually. Because his brother is like, you should go.
Oh, yeah.
It's a whole thing, yeah. Six is going to therapy, and then you find out that, like, his therapist just has a twin therapist who's, like, sitting in the back of the room. That was a pretty funny thing.
Yeah.
Sitting in the back of the room like, hey, yeah, he does the therapy, and I just sort of observe. That's my job. And there's this amazing scene where Two goes in.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
To talk about, like, you know, my son, maybe my son doesn't love me and all this stuff. And like, what, am I a bad dad? Am I a bad person? And the psychiatrist guy's like, no, you're great. And then Two like takes out a grenade and like throws it at the guy without taking the thing out. And it's like, I don't care about psychiatry and blah, blah. He blows up at him. That was a really cool scene. And I think my favorite scene was the one where in Schizoid, where Two is split, he's now Untwo,
yeah.
And Untwo goes to the store. Another good bit of comedy in the first one, the map scene. They did a funny version of the map
scene.
That's
great.
Think.
Yeah, that's what you can do that. I have nothing wrong with that. Like
where the map unfolds and is like so big, it's as big as the room almost.
Yeah, gigantic map, but still doesn't show anything. Is a very good gag. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you talk about the cigarette scene.
Two goes in to buy some cigarettes, and they just talk about like how much they love cigarettes.
Yeah, he's like, I don't sell these to anyone. Don't tell anyone I have them. But God, I miss these things a lot. And he's like, yeah, you do. I do too. Let's light up together. And they just smoke a cigarette together. It's a wonderful scene.
Yeah,
and it's all in McKellen's performance.
He just brings in so many layers, and he pivots between the layers that he's doing effortlessly. Yeah. It's like such smooth transitions between I'm being your buddy, but now I'm like being really menacing and villainous. And now I'm phasing out of that. Like nothing happened. It's really the characterization of Two in this show. I find intriguing because in The Prisoner, the original, there were so many number twos who were just like straight across the plate.
Yeah.
They were like, hey, number six, I want you to join us, okay? And we're going to do some wacky shit to try to get you to do that. Sound good?
Yeah.
And Patrick McGoohan's like, I see what you're doing. I'm not going to fall for it or whatever. Mm-hmm. But this number two in this show, his whole thing is I'm going to relentlessly gaslight you in as many different ways as I can think of. Like first, just make you think that you live here. Second episode, make you think that you have a brother. And that's normal. Third episode, like get you to be the one to watch people while you're being watched, but then I get you to work for me because you want to. Fourth episode, like you love this lady. Fifth episode, who knows? That's a weird one. And then sixth episode, like I'm going to get you to take my job because I don't want it anymore. And I'm going to get you to realize that you do want to do my job.
Yeah.
So that I found cool. And in some ways more modern and better realized than some of the number two plots from the original, but also more bleak because like, as soon as you give number two the power to, inject me with something that makes me think I used to have a brother, it's like, well, what am I supposed to do?
Yeah.
I can't resist that.
I want to talk about number two's son in a moment, but one of the other things that I can tell was somewhat intentional, at least in the writing, was that the show's continuity, like shot continuity, is very uneven. Like oftentimes Six will just kind of walk up in a scene and be like, oh, I guess I'm here now. Like as if he's waking up every time we see him in a new scene. That's like a very common thing in this show. And there's one of those in Schizoid where he just appears in front of number two's like mansion and all of the guards like tackle him down. And then like number two is there and he's like, hey, my doppelganger is going to kill you. And he's like, is number six? Is it number six? And he's like, yeah, but it's not me. And he's like, but he's angry, right? And he's like, yeah, but I'm not. And he's like, no, but it is you. And this whole like, who are you talking about? And like, I'm going to let you try to kill me. And like, it's fine if you do, because I'm not, if you're not number six, I'm not number two. Just like climbing into the number six's head and being like, everything you think is wrong. Even when you when you're positive that right. you have a grasp on reality, you know, we cut away when like the doppelganger number six is tackling him to the ground, being like, you have to kill number two. And the cutaway shows that the number six is in his head. Like everything is being manipulated around six, and it's all within the hands of number two, which I think works really well.
Right. Yeah. It's just so much more, it's much more frequent that six is like not in control in this show. And I think in the original, even in episodes where he was meant to be sort of in an uncertain situation, it would always end with him getting the upper hand or him getting out of it. And very rarely would six like fail. Or he would, fail, but he would be conscious of the failure. Like in Many Happy Returns, for example, it ends with him being like, all right, well, that you got me. But in this, like in Harmony, I think it is, it ends with him being like carted away for treatment, and Two's like, who are you? And then he's like, I'm not six. And Two's like, who are you? And then he's like, I'm six. Like he forgets his name and shouts that he's number six and stuff.
Yeah, that was another one of those like, wow, McGoohan's number six would have never been like, it's me, six. Like number six is more successfully broken, I think.
Yeah.
Which is, again, fun considering the ending.
Right.
Hello, everybody. Sorry to interrupt your episode, but it's Alan, and I'm here to read the last email that we received about the prisoner and prisoner chats from our friend Nick, as well as a brief little public service announcement. So first up, we have our email from Nick, which he is a friend of the podcast, as everyone knows, and he sent this email over to chatspod@gmail.com, which you can do as well if you have comments that you'd like to have us read on the show, or not, if you just want us to read your comments to ourselves. Nick says, so the end of The Prisoner was great. It was all the amount of weird and strange action that, if you're in the mood for it, is great, and if you're a straightforward viewer in the late 60s, you probably hate it. Which is fair. The number one is yourself answer is probably the most sane explanation possible for the identity of who is number one. The most boring version that I can come up with is that number 12, as seen in The Schizoid Man, was actually not killed by the Rover, you know, because it's never explained why only that time it actually killed someone, and that he was in fact number one, monkey mask and all. And yeah, that's definitely the most like milquetoast explanation. Like, I would imagine some one-season drama that nobody talks about has some twist like that where a character, like a side character from a random episode ends up being the main bad guy, but you weren't paying attention. That's a very, like, dumb thing. He says, I am, of course, still upset that we never got McGoohan guesting on Babylon 5, as was planned, though the actors that replaced him did a fine job, and he references this about the season one episode where they kidnap and electro-interrogate his mind/dreams. I'm assuming that he's talking about Sinclair. I didn't know about that. I didn't know that McGoohan was literally going to... I probably did. Like, you can probably listen back to a Chat Salon episode, and I knew that, but now I'm not knowing that. But very cool, and unfortunate that it didn't get to be him regardless. He concludes, in regards to the 09 remake, it does find that balance between not good and not so bad it's good. It's cringy whenever it references things from the original series, and it has some really bizarre WTF moments, like the kid on the toy bike riding straight into the hole. He says, I'm sorry I laughed. And Nick, if it's not before this email segment, it's after this email segment where I mentioned that exact same scene as an unintentional laugh for me. It's absurd. It's truly absurd. And at least with the original, it mostly saved those moments for the last two episodes, not scattered over the whole run. He concludes that the ending was an okay idea, and I think that if you did an original show about this, maybe cast off its remake shadow, you could make something decent with it. It's a good point. Black Mirror does equally twisty concepts, so it could just be that in a single episode. Yeah, like just a single Black Mirror episode, but if it was Black Mirror, it would be really corny, and it would end with something like him walking off the side of the world and falling into number two's wife's brain or something dumb like that. Like we would get that bad CG visual. But that is our email from Nick. Thank you, as always, our friend, for emailing us and keeping up the community. Nick also co-runs the chat subreddit at reddit.com/r/chatspod, which if you haven't checked out, you simply must. I'm now caught up on their their old chats, like throwback re-listen. And it's a lot of fun. It's really cool listening back to us talk about Farscape, and we're going to keep going through chats kind of in like a time machine format. It's great. And Nick is great. And thank you for your email. Now, if you're still listening, and I hope you are, we want to call attention to something briefly, use our podcast platform, small as it is, to talk about what's going on in the world right now. As we all are dealing with Corona-19, COVID-19, quarantine hell. I mean, I don't even know the words anymore because we've been living in it for so long that I'm just like stumbling just to talk about it. The Rona, Miss Rona, the deadly virus. Here in the United States, we're dealing with some other really awful things compounding with all of that anxiety. Specifically, the murder of Minnesota resident George Floyd. By the Minnesota Police Department officer, Derek Chauvin. An awful, awful, completely fucked up event that has sparked a lot of rioting and protesting in the city of Minneapolis. It's gotten pretty severe. And while I do, I'll say at least for myself and Magellan, we support these rioters and support the citizens' ability to ask for justice for something that was so cruel and unfair and represents a general white supremacist, deeply, deeply racist police force and police structure and how that needs to be completely disassembled in order for this country to be even remotely equitable to its people. Neither of us are, of course, black folks, and you should, as always, listen to black folks, especially when there are issues concerning them primarily. These are things that they're dealing with every single day around the world, and especially in the United States now. Give your money to them, support art, support black art, but also, let's help this movement move forward a little bit. I'm going to be linking to two charities in the podcast description. One is called the Minnesota Freedom Fund. And if you're on Twitter right now, I'm sure you've heard about it. It's trending all over the place. Basically, the Minnesota Freedom Fund is a nonprofit aiming to pay the bail of all of the protesters and rioters in Minneapolis right now so that they don't have to be sitting in jail just waiting on bail for no reason. Bail is a completely fucked concept if you ever read about it. And it's they're doing really important work in helping people not have to be in prison unfairly. So Minnesota Freedom Fund, they have a donation link. You can do PayPal or through their website. Also, if you want something a little bit more specific and personal, the official George Floyd Memorial Fund is a fund going directly to the Floyd family. So if you want to donate to them, they have a GoFundMe, which is GoFundMe.com/F/George Floyd. And I'll also be linking that in the podcast description if you want your voice to be heard. Donate to those. Call your senators. Vote. It's not even, a lot of this stuff just feels very empty right now, and I understand that. Like, the whole, like, you should vote is, like, not the best. You should protest. You should get out there, and you should fight for what's right. That's all I'll say for now. I will let the podcast continue now, and we hope you enjoy the rest of this episode of Prisoner Chats. And I think you talked before about how this show kind of it's brought down by its relationship to the original. And while I mostly agree, I think there are like little moments here and there that I was texting you about, kind of jokingly but kind of seriously, about like they understood the ending of the original episode and decided to flip it in a fun way. I think Checkmate is the perfect example of that, where instead of having like the entirety, every viewer get super mad at you and have to go into hiding, they're like, no, I'm number two. You know, number six is number two. We're the same. They just make that less ambiguous, and that kind of works. But it's also like you're watching it in response to the original ending of the series, and being like, okay, in that version, he is literally taking a mask off and seeing himself. But maybe like it's ambiguous whether or not that's literally him or if it's a clone. Like that's the fun of it. But in this, it's like, no, he's the new number two. It's not ambiguous. Right. Like he's the guy. Right. Also, the other moment that I loved. Is because I was talking about the weird like continuity, is at one point Six just finds himself as a teacher. He's like,
oh yeah, that's right, I really like that one.
Yeah, that's really charming. You get to, and then you like, it's a little goofy, but in the right...
When he walks in, they're like, okay, so they're going to have history, gym, and then they're going to go to your class, surveillance studies.
Yeah.
And he's like, why am I teaching surveillance studies? And the guy's like, well, it's your class, dude.
I don't tell you what to teach. Do you ever walk into your history classes and you're like, wait, why do I teach U.S. history? And they're like, what?
Yeah, all the time. And people are like, what? That's just your job.
Yeah. But the moment that's in there that's funny is he's kind of using them to ask questions about the village, because he's like, oh, the youth are trained in the truths of the village. So he's who's number one? Which is a commonly asked question in the original series. And in this, they're like, they don't say, like, there is no number one or don't worry about it. They say, like, number one, there isn't a number one because number two always has to be in deference to something, to the people. Yeah. He's number two out of, like, there doesn't exist a number one. Don't worry, that question's not worth asking. It's intentional that he's two. Because
it's an act of humility, the little girl says, which is awesome.
Yeah.
That's actually it's a satisfying answer to that question.
Totally. I would argue that's more satisfying than, like, your number one.
Right. Also, that episode ends with somebody had been, like, putting a spy camera on his estate, and then he, like, brings that girl and is like, hey, this is right at your head height, huh? And you did this. And she's like, yeah. And then he's like, they're going to have to send you in for treatment. She's like, aw. And he's like, you can finish your ice cream first.
And then we cut to the car driving over the ice cream.
Of the ice cream falling on the ground,
And then she screams?
Yeah, that was a little silly, but...
It's just cut that like 5 seconds earlier and you have a pretty sharp ending.
Right. You want to talk about number two's son? I think that's the only stone we've left unturned.
Yeah, the actual B plot of the series, and that Jamie Campbell Bauer is 11-12, the son of number two. He is at first the like traditional drama series character of like the silent but always watching and always listening type. And we're like, what's his deal? Why is he so mysterious? And then by like episode two or three, I think, we understand that other people know him and have familiarity with him, not separately from number two. And we learn that after nighttime, he goes to a secret bar where there's like sexy dancers and alcohol and like people and rebels. And he goes there and he hangs out every night at the bar. And this is his like opportunity to get away from his father and to like carve out his own identity. But through that and through the various confidants that he makes throughout the plot, he comes to understand that like his mom's condition and the fact that he grew up without a mom is not, it's not his fault. It's not like just a health issue. It's induced by drugs. Yeah. And so he enlists Ruth Wilson's character to determine what like the toxicity of each of the drugs. And she like brings the pills to him in the bar and it's like, this one's a hallucinogen. This one's a, you know, this one knocks you out, and this one, well, I don't think this one does anything.
Yeah, I have no idea what this one is.
Well, I think she says it has nothing in it.
Nothing that she could identify.
Or, yeah, I guess. What it was. I thought it would be fun if she was like, and this one's a sugar pill.
Yeah, that's just because rule three.
Right.
Maybe I should have said that one first, actually.
Yeah, in hindsight, that makes more sense. And so he's like, wait, my mom's being drugged into a coma. This is messed up. And then that leads to him choking her out of her coma by the end. But he talks with her and she's like, yeah, the village is the way it is and it has to be this way. And just because you were born here doesn't mean you're defective or anything. And he's like, it kind of does. Like, I don't exist, do I? And rebels against that by...
Yeah, because he's like, how do you leave? And she's like, well, yeah, anybody can leave except you. You can't because you were
born here.
Yeah. Which is kind of interesting, I guess. If you're going to do this story where there's like a simulation world... It makes sense to have one of the characters be like from the simulation and struggling with, am I real? Is my consciousness real? That's cool.
Yeah. And it's a better like youthful rebellion story than the guy from the Western, from Living in Harmony in the original Prisoner, where it's like, wait, why is this guy the like icon of young rebellion? It's like, this actually makes more sense. This guy is like, I want to exist. I need to assert that I'm real and I belong here. And he can't because everything's fake. I liked him. It's a good performance. It's very quiet and subdued, but it works.
I think that guy does a good job. I'm sort of resentful of the like grimdark shit that comes with him, where in Anvil, he has this secret affair going on with number two's right-hand man. And then when it gets found out, he like stabs him in the neck and you see blood squirting out of him and stuff. It's like, do you need to do that?
I believe that's the scene with the classic I texted you, like, you know, it's a 2010s drama when somebody gets stabbed to a, like an old 50s song.
Yeah, I think they play the Beach Boys song Heroes and Villains, which I gotta tell you, it worked on me a little bit because I just love the Beach Boys.
Dude, it always works.
Yeah, it always works. And then the very ending shot is set to the Beach Boys song, I Know There's an Answer, which is like, all right, that's a pretty good choice.
Yeah.
You picked a good one there.
That's it's an extremely tropey thing, but I like it consistently. Like, nothing beats a action scene set to, or a murder scene set to old-timey music, honestly.
Yeah.
It's like a guilty pleasure.
But then he, like, 11-12 ends up hanging himself, and it's a whole, like, okay. And they show him hung from like 10 different camera angles in a row.
Yeah.
It's like, here are his feet. All right, now here's the whole body. Now it's from two's perspective. Now it's his legs.
I wonder.
Stop it.
It makes me remember. It reminds me that the original Prisoner like never needed to show. It showed blood like one time.
Right. There was almost no violence.
Yeah. The violence really doesn't enhance any of this stuff. Maybe that was like a network mandate or something. Like, if you're going to take the M rating on your show, the TV MA rating, then there has to be like something to justify that. But again, having the queer character in your show too, be like, he has to kill his partner and whatever and all that stuff.
Yeah. Right. Right.
Ugh, bad. And it's 09.
You know, right. And it is a Magoon thing. That, you know, he didn't want to glorify or romanticize violence. And I do think there is something to be said for the fact that, like, murdering your boyfriend to a Beach Boys song really romanticizes violence.
Yeah.
And makes it this, like, beautiful thing, this tragic, beautiful thing in a way that is problematic. And I think that Magoon would have had issues with. I think pretty categorically he would not have liked this adaptation.
Right. No, Magoon would have hated this adaptation.
Yeah. Those scenes also feel very Breaking Bad. Like, that feels like the Breaking Bad DNA in this, of the, we picked a old-timey song and did a violent murder to it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The last episodes felt really Inception-y to me, but Inception came out in 2010, which kind of blew my mind, because I thought for sure they were stealing from Inception a little bit.
In which way? In what way?
Well, two is like there are levels of consciousness, and there's this sort of parallel, like there's the real world and then the dream world. And then if you die in the dream, you go back to the real world.
So there was a film, I think it's from 1999. This is like indie film. I think it's called The Matrix.
Yeah, you're right.
Everything you just said to me.
I did think of The Matrix also. I have seen it. We watched it.
It's before anyone yells at Majel, we've seen The Matrix. We know.
I was listening to our episode from last week, and there was this thing at the beginning where I was like, TV is the only medium that we experience, like, you know, in sequential chunks. And I was listening to it, and I was like, comic books, comic books, comic books.
You were the fan base yelling at us.
I was the fan. I wish I could have sent an email into myself.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. The other like moment of violence that I thought was super like gratuitous, but also I kind of liked, was in the last episode where two is like, okay, there are those little pills for you, and then there's this nice big green pill for me, and he sticks a grenade in his mouth and takes the pin
out. My delicious green pill. Boom, boom, boom. Yeah.
He explodes his head.
I just wish they cut away. Like, they showed a little bit too much of that explosion.
Yeah, they popped his whole head off. They showed it to you. It's stupid.
Stupid. I have a fondness for this remake. Like, I understand the ambition of it, and I appreciate the ambition of it. And I think it fails in interesting ways, which is why I'm glad that we're covering it. And it's not discussed much in this way that we are. Like, the general criticism I read online about it was at the time, because 2009, you definitely have like TV criticism starting to blow up in a big way.
Yeah.
Is people being like, there isn't any comedy. They answer things that they shouldn't have answered, and it looks like shit. Which are all true, but I think it goes deeper than that, because there's a lot of cool ideas under there. It's just missing the allegory and missing the heart, which are like the two core things that make The Prisoner work really well.
Right. The Wikipedia page for the show has a treasure trove of quotes from different TV critics who were not fond of the show.
Oh, boy.
If I could read those.
Please.
Los Angeles Times television critic Robert Lloyd wrote, "Why anyone on either side of the screen should be particularly interested in his fate is never made clear nor compelling."
True.
And further states, "The payoff is weak and more than a bit daffy." In a comparison with the miniseries to AMC's hit series Mad Men, he writes, "The difference is that Mad Men is never boring." Which is true. Also, Mad Men is funny.
Yes, also Mad Men's quite funny. And intentionally. Yeah.
In Entertainment Weekly, TV critic Ken Tucker writes, "It lacks the wit and zip of the original Prisoner," and concludes, "It's self-absorbed to the point of incoherence." It's a little harsh.
Is it self-absorbed?
I don't know that it's self-absorbed. I think it's very self-serious.
Yeah. Part of it is it isn't even, I feel like it isn't even that proud of its own, like, twist.
Yeah,
like, it obfuscates
yeah.
so much of what is clear about that twist.
Yes. Yes. That was the problem I had with it, is, like, you have the idea, but you don't have any confidence in that premise, and so you hide it until the end and then reveal it, and then it's over.
Like, when I texted you my guess around episode 4. I was like, is it all inside of number 2's wife's head? And you were like, how did you do that? Because I do this thing sometimes where I've watched enough shit that I know how plot twists work. But then yeah. I was watching more and I was like, no, they literally, like, they don't even want to hide that because they keep cutting to scenes of her in the office building in the present. Like, they don't want to hide their own twist. But then it's like, well, then what does it mean? Why should I be like, oh my God, I figured it out. Like, I knew that. You showed it to me.
It was cute that the flashbacks turned out to be concurrent.
Yeah.
But it wasn't cute enough that that needed to be hidden the whole time. Like, I don't know. I got into this argument with my brother. It wasn't like a big argument, but we were playing Halo 1 yesterday.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah.
And there's a part in Halo 1 where you, before you meet the Flood, who are like the zombifying aliens, mm-hmm. where Cortana, your computer AI girlfriend,
yep.
is like, oh no, there's a big problem. You have to go stop it. There's no time to explain. And I just think whenever a character is like, there's no time to explain, that's lazy and dumb. And he was like, well, but it builds the suspense if you don't know what's going on. And I was like, but I know what the Flood is already. I know it's a weird, creepy zombie alien thing. And I'm scared out of my mind right now. I haven't seen them yet. And I know they're coming and I'm very scared.
You don't have to tell me that.
Right. If the game told me, like, hey, there's something called the Flood, or hey, there's some creepy zombie aliens, I think it would still have an effect on me. Like, you don't always have to make things a secret, you know?
Yeah.
Sometimes if you just say what it is, then you can explore all the implications of what that is. And I think a big fundamental difference between the original Prisoner and this one is, in the original Prisoner,
they're not concerned with hiding it from you.
Yeah, they are very clear with you about, like, here's what we're going to answer and here's what we're not going to answer. Mm-hmm. And there are questions like, why did he resign? Where is the island? That are sort of perfunctory detail questions where the show's like, it doesn't matter. We're making it clear to you that it doesn't matter. We're not going to tell you because that's distracting. Whereas with this show, questions like, why did he resign? Where is the island? Are questions where they're like, hey, we're going to answer these questions for you, but not yet. And so the whole time, that's all you can think about is what are the answers to the questions, instead of in the original where you're thinking about, like, how does this apply to my life? How does this show up in my society? You know, who is this guy? I want to understand him a little bit better. And so in that sense, I think it really misses the mark of what the purpose of the Prisoner is, and what the purpose of, like, confusion is in the Prisoner. Because we talked about in my mind, the moment where Patrick McGoohan, in the previously unaired interview footage, he's like, my goal was to confuse you. And then he turns the lights off and leaves. And this show, I think, would say, like, oh yeah, we're trying to confuse you too. But it's like, you're not really, it's not the same thing.
No,
you know?
Yeah, I agree. It's because it feels like I said, it's that lack of confidence, or like, you're either do exactly the Prisoner twist and, like, change up how you get there, or just completely disregard it and don't make it even vaguely similar. Like, all my other guesses about, like, oh, is it all in somebody's head? That's an easy one. Is it, like, actually a story being written by someone? Like, the Prisoner's done all that stuff. So, you know, choose your plot twist and go barrel straight towards it. And don't just give it to me, drip feed it to people who are watching the show. Like, I usually miss stuff like that. I usually miss, like, and it's supposed to be rewarding for people going back and watching it and going, oh, like, if I think about it, The Prisoner 2009 explains its twist early. But, like, no, literally, there are just shots where they say it. They basically just show her there. And that's not satisfying. And but, like, when we say, like, you know, you don't have to, the questions aren't that important, I think the J.J. Abrams and, like, Damon Lindelof and company's school of storytelling directly contradicts that. And it's why I don't like a lot of it, but I'm still a sucker for it sometimes.
Yeah, it's, like, fun. It can be fun to watch.
Yeah.
But, and I think there's a good quote. I had sort of stopped reading the critical quotes on the Wikipedia page. There's more, but there's this nice quote here from the New York Times reviewer, Alessandra Stanley.
Okay.
Where she says, the 21st century adaptation pays only lip service to the human condition and instead explores a power struggle between two human beings. It's unlikely to prove as lasting, but the new series still manages to be thrilling. And I think that there's something to be said for that, that, like, it's fun to watch in the way that TV that is competently made is fun to watch, and there are questions that you're going to get the answers to, and the story concludes. Like, I don't think there are really any, there are, like, holes you can poke in it, but I don't think there are any dangling threads. So it does have that quality, like you're saying, of being entertaining, but then it's ultimately, like, you are not asked to make any of the meaning yourself. Whereas in The Prisoner, you are asked to make quite a lot of the meaning.
Yeah.
And then ultimately, what is the entertainment in service of when you are done with this show?
I think a lot of showrunners have taken the ideas of The Prisoner and comics writers. I mean, like, Grant Morrison, I found an interview with him where he was like, yeah, every mystery I've ever written was because I really loved The Prisoner. And I just wanted to reach that, like, height of mystery storytelling in my story. I think it's Grant Morrison. But, like, Lindelof and Abrams were initially, like, well, Abrams more of a producer role, but they were both big on the creation of Lost. And whereas Lindelof went off to create The Leftovers, which is a show that has a central underlying question that it basically never answers because that's not important, Lindelof is the guy who in 2007 did a TED Talk that I highly recommend you, Magellan, check out if you haven't, about The Mystery Box, which is basically him telling a story about how he bought a mystery box at a magic shop that was $15, but promised $50 worth of mystery inside of it. And he never opened it because it has infinite potential as long as it remains closed. And he says that basically that's how he likes to write TV narratives, is like, it's way more interesting if I never tell you. So, like, he understands that, but I don't think the mystery by itself should be the reward. I don't think just the questioning of, like, what could this be? Like, you know, I want something for me to think about, like some dangling thread of, like, oh, this could mean something, or this could be this, you know?
Right. It definitely, this show also feels like it's borrowing from, like, the Schizoid episode felt very Fight Club to me.
Yeah.
Because there's scenes where, like,
there's a real person inside of you who knows how to live in society and function better.
Right. And there's even, like, a scene where he's, like, strangling himself, and then you see a shot where he's clearly imagining the other person.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that feels like totally Fight Club. And so there's something to, like, this show is trying to do the kind of thing that Fight Club or, like, Memento does, where at the end of the movie they say, by the way, here's how this has been working the whole time. And I think it works better in Memento. In Fight Club, it's, I'm sure if you were to revisit Fight Club, it's probably pretty dorky. But it just doesn't do it with, there's not much interesting about how it does it.
Yeah.
And then also, since it's a mini series, it's like you got more time to explore other things rather than this one idea.
Right.
In thinking about this, I wrote in the notes something that I wanted to talk about, with regard to this was, I saw a trailer for David Lynch's Masterclass.
Oh, boy.
And he said something in that I found really fascinating, which was his advice on making a film is ideas are everything. Every time you have an idea, put it on an index card. Once you have 70 ideas, you have a film.
Huh.
which says quite a lot about how David Lynch approaches storytelling. Uh-huh. That he just like crams a bunch of like dreamy shit in there.
And then has to stitch it together with needle and thread.
Right, and figure out how it works together. And also it leaves the audience in a place of like, you have to figure out how it works and what matters and what doesn't to you. And interpret it the way you would interpret like one of your own dreams almost. And this show really feels like a show where they didn't have enough index cards. They had like a couple. They had an idea or two or three or five or whatever. And then they stitched it together with a lot of the just the chaff of how stories are told on TV in 2009 mm-hmm. with the stock camera shots and the stock ways that characters interact with things. And it makes it boring. You know, I just don't think that there are enough prisonery ideas in this show. And the great ideas that it has, it hides them and is not confident in them, like you said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think, I do kind of think that you could, you there. It's possible to make something very similar to The Prisoner. I mean, they do that. There are mystery shows. Like, if you want to make The Prisoner again, there's, I don't know if it's even worth doing that anymore. Like, guy on an island doesn't know why he's there. Like, we've done that. We've exhausted that. There is no more merit in, like, trying to remake The Prisoner because it's so singular and of its time that...
Right. And I think also The Prisoner is a show about, like, how do you resist an autocracy that is, like, very obvious. Like, Magoon is essentially making it in part in response to, like, Nazi Germany. Mm-hmm. He talks about that in My Mind. And evil doesn't look like that today.
Yeah.
Evil, I think, is much more subtle and insidious. And so there are shows, there's a need for shows to confront, like, what is oppression and what does conformity look like in our society in ways that look different from The Prisoner. And I think that this show gestures at trying to do that. And in moments, it's successful, but overall, it's mostly not.
It's a fascinating whiff and reminds me of a time when you could just do this. You could just pump out these like little mini series that people forget about. Like, no one's talking about the 09 Prisoner because they just keep making these or kept making these for a while. And eventually people get tired of it and they realize they have to do other things than just tee up a mystery and attempt to solve it by the end of the show. Like, that's not conducive to good fiction alone.
Yeah. I think like Mad Men tackles some of the things that this show wants to do a lot better than it does.
Yeah.
You know, like the sort of frailty of modern conformist life and all the ways that it's fucked up and we're fucked up. And
yeah.
I'm so fucked up.
Uncut Gems, truly the best version of criticism of modern economic times. Not entirely being full of shit here, folks.
Right.
Yeah. Do you have anything else to talk about with this 09 little thing here?
I don't know. I had a lot of like stray notes that I took as the show was going, but I don't think it's worthwhile to talk about like all these little plot points.
Yeah. I mean, I'm really glad we decided to cover all this at once. Like, I know when I told you what I was two episodes in, we were like, oh, should we have done this two episodes at a time? And the only benefit I think that would have gotten us would to drill deeper into like, what could the themes of this be? But like, it's a mini series. It's never going to come back. All these actors are still doing things. Like, this is totally cut. I feel like we have sufficiently litigated the entirety of The Prisoner 09. I like a lot of the performances. We didn't talk much about Haley Atwell's character. Her and Ruth Wilson are just such underrated talents, especially at this time. They were both like,
I think Ruth Wilson's not given enough to do. I think Haley Atwell does a good job.
Yeah. And the slow drip feed of like, oh, in the what we realize later is the present, like number six is like flirting with her and he's got a drinking problem and then he goes to work. Like, really, you could boil down all of the present scenes into like a 2 minute cut where he's like mad at her and then he goes to work the next day and he's driven there by the guy and then he gets there and Curtis is there and he resigns and all this stuff. Speaking, like I said earlier, too, of how it...
They also, sorry, the like drinking problem thing, they kind of allude to, but they never really do that much with it.
It's just that scene, which they come back to a couple times, but it's basically that.
Well, and there's shots of he has like a liquor cabinet in his apartment in the village.
Oh, I didn't notice.
Something. Yeah, but they don't really do that much with
it. I think it's just supposed, maybe it's supposed to be like his the inside of his head. Like he's thinking about that stuff a lot, so it shows, it manifests in the village. Mm. Or like his consciousness manifests in the village. But like it being a little bit in conversation with the original show, the present day number six is being asked constantly, why did you resign? And I'm like, wait, oh, that's so different. That's so interestingly different than what the original prisoner is asking, which is like, why did you resign? That's why you're on the village. Or like, why did you resign? That's why we had to take you. His core question. It's like way, it's kind of brushed to the side, but they still ask that. They still like know the script of the show. Like, right. I would never say that the show and its writers didn't watch or didn't like the original Prisoner. I don't think that. I think they definitely watched it and definitely tried to make something based on that.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I did think it was really dumb that the intro sequence includes him spray painting the word resign
stupid
on his window.
Dumb and stupid. Stupid. Yep.
Dumb and stupid. Yeah. Okay.
That was my, I mean, when I texted you when I watched the final shot, because you were like, the final shot's interesting, which I do agree it is, but my only reaction in the moment was like, dumb, stupid, and dumb. Because predicted, I said, it's either going to, when you were like, can you guess what you think the final shot's going to be? And I was like, well, it's either going to be the number two's wife waking up, and like, he's the doctor, or it's going to be number six, like, looking over like a horizon and seeing something crazy, like a big city or something. And it was kind of both.
Yeah, you were half right on both.
Because she wakes up, except he's not the doctor, and then he looks over the horizon, but it's just the village. And this whole thing, they never, again, like, missed opportunity in the village. In the village. They can always see two towers from New York City in the background, and everyone says, you can never reach the towers, don't go to the towers. We learn later that that's just the Summa Corp building, but like, two towers in New York, you guys got, you did it, you can just do that. I mean, it's like weird.
Yeah, why are they doing that? That was weird to me. Why are you doing this Twin Towers thing?
Like, yeah, don't say that and then not commit. Like you said, you put two towers in New York City.
It was strange.
Very.
There were two little, I think, intentional homages to shows that we love in here that I wanted to mention.
Oh, yeah.
One was when Jim Caviezel's getting mad at Haley Atwell, he's like, at one point he says, who are you and what do you want?
Yeah.
I like to think that's a B5 reference.
Love it.
Or it's a Prisoner reference, and B5 references the Prisoner.
Yeah.
And then there's just a moment where Untu in Schizoid goes to the house of 147 and his wife, and they give him cake. And he just says, damn fine cake.
Damn fine cake.
Like, okay, I guess we're just doing a Twin Peaks thing. That's cute.
Oh my God, I just realized, if you like the Schizoid episode of The Prisoner 09, then you gotta watch the Twin Peaks season 3.
I mean, from what I've seen of Twin Peaks season 3, it realizes those ideas so much better.
Yes, it's basically like 13 episode or whatever version of the Schizoid episode of like, wait, there's another one of me getting around? Why? What's up with that?
Right.
There's more to it. Right. Oh. BRB, watching all of Twin Peaks season 3 again right now.
Well, and I think Twin Peaks The Return is an example of how you can do what Prisoner 09 is doing, because it's like doing Twin Peaks sort of, but it's a totally different thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's not doing what the original was doing, but it has like a similar sensibility in terms of like, what can TV accomplish and what are we trying to do here? So I think that obviously it's the same creator, which helps to make that happen. But, I think that's an example of like, if the Prisoner 09 is an instance where it's a whiff, or Twin Peaks The Return feels like it's an instance where it is as good as the original at whatever it is it's trying to do.
Yeah. It's trying to do different things while also being in conversation with the original in a meaningful way that reflects the changing time. It also helps that, like you said, the creator being alive, and it's not so far into the future that, like, the world is a fundamentally different place. I mean, it is different than where we were at in, like, 94 or whatever, but, you know, there are people who were alive in the creation of Twin Peaks that can still be alive and talk about in The Return, and they brought people on like that. David Lynch, for example.
True.
But, yeah, it made me think about that a lot. Like, how do you do a reboot, especially a TV reboot? That's a very... challenging thing.
Right.
Oh, it's 18 episodes. All right, that's way too much for us to chat. Sorry, guys. We only watched...
Twin Peaks of Return is 18?
Yeah.
Oh.
No, we wouldn't chat to that, but I just want Magellan to watch it really badly.
We could chat to it. Okay. I mean, I don't think we should right now, someday.
What should we chat next, Magellan?
Well, isn't that a fun question? I actually have an answer for you.
What?
I know. For those of you who are patrons, you already had this information, but this is being unveiled to the general listening public right now. We got so into doing a mini-series, we were like, hey, let's do another mini-series. So, Alan, we are going to be covering the 1995 television mini-series adaptation of the classic Jane Austen novel Pride and Prejudice.
Oh, play the theme song! Is there a theme song?
Yeah, there is.
Okay,
there
good.
Is
play the theme song. Yeah. Hell yeah, everybody. It's Pride and Prejudice time. It's my season now because we're doing period pieces and I am thriving. No, we really enjoyed doing this one for Pilot Chats. I think people who are patrons can hear that and discover us discovering the joy of the show and how fun and interesting it is. And I mean, we got like an hour and a half out of like our limited time Pilot Chats format. So I imagine doing it two episodes a week, we'll have so much to talk about.
Yeah. Yeah, we like to each subsequent show be a sort of different thing from what we just did. We like to kind of space it out and explore different corners of TV. We've never done I think every show that we've done so far has been an original for TV story, actually. And so this will be the first that's adapted from a different medium. This is obviously a sort of like romance grounded in history thing, which we haven't done before. So we're excited to explore and to watch. And we'll be doing it throughout the month of June. So what we'll do is we will do, there are six episodes. We'll do two a week, just like normal. And then the fourth week of June, we will do a commentary of the 2005 Keira Knightley version of Pride and Prejudice. And then once we get to July, we'll be doing something totally different. So if Pride and Prejudice isn't your speed, give it a shot. If you don't want to watch it, you know, we've got other stuff you can listen to for the next month. And then we'll be back doing something else. And to sweeten the pot, can I sweeten the Pride and Prejudice pot here a little
Please
bit?
Sweeten the pot.
My mom loves Pride and Prejudice, adores it. So she is going to be on one of our episodes. If that's fun, sounds fun.
Magellan.
What?
That apparently that impression is so good. I did it at dinner yesterday unintentionally, and my sister was like, "Why are you doing Crash Bandicoot?" And I was like, "Oh shit!
Wow, wow! Yeah, that's a very good Crash Bandicoot."
Wow! Thank you.
Yeah, that's great. If you want us to play Crash Bandicoot for the Patreon, we'll gladly do it.
We would love it. You would love it.
Yeah. Do you want to know what the descriptions are for the episodes we're watching next week?
Yes.
Yeah. And we're not going to take a break because The Prisoner was short. Sometimes we take a break after the long, long shows, but we're just going to roll right into Chats and Prejudice.
Which, by the way, for folks who want to watch the show, this is always important to mention. Hulu has all of Pride and Prejudice 95. And if you can get a subscription to BritBox through Amazon Prime Video channels and watch it through that. There are plenty of ways to stream this for cheap, if not free.
Cool. So next time we're watching episodes 1 and 2 of Pride and Prejudice, the 95 series. Episode 1, the description says, two rich, eligible, and handsome young bachelors gallop into Hertfordshire and the lives of ever hopeful young maiden and her ambitious mama in the neighborhood. The lives of every hopeful young maiden and her ambitious mama in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Mr. Bingley has bought Netherfield Park and has brought his sisters and friend, Mr. Darcy, with him. To Mrs. Bennet at Longbourn House, they are the answer to her prayers. She has five daughters to marry, and their dowries are not large. Episode 2. It's just the most mundane stuff.
It sounds like the most mundane show, and then it turns out it's the best.
Yeah. The other thing I was going to say to sweeten the pot is I'm going to try to actually read the book.
Oh, fuck. It's a good book.
Yeah. Episode 2, the Bennets are expecting a visitor, Mr. Bennet's clergyman cousin, who will inherit the estate in the absence of any direct male heirs. Mr. Collins is coming to Longbourn with the intention of healing the rift between his branch of the family and the Bennets. Though Mrs. Bennet cannot help thinking he has come to check over the place, he arrives with the best of intentions. When I read that just now, I was like, oh, fuck, that's going to be a spicy episode. Like, I'm having the same reaction that I would to a sort of, like, a sprawling sci-fi epic.
It's the thing, yeah. It kind of gives you a type of brainworms that I love, which is that once you get into this type of story, if you read stuff like, and then this person makes a marriage proposal, and you're like, fuck,
no.
Shit, ass, no, that garbage man. Like, once you're into it that deep, you're in for life, baby.
Right, exactly.
And yeah, as you said, this is the 95. This is like the iconic Brian Regis. There are so many different adaptations, but this is the BBC
this
one,
is the
Colin Firth one.
Colin Firth, Jennifer Ehle. Yeah. Jennifer Ehle. I don't know how to say her name.
I think it's Ehle. I've heard it pronounced before. We'll make sure to know that at some point.
Yeah. Cool. That's what we're watching next week. We hope that you join us for that. If you have people in your life who like Pride and Prejudice, you know, maybe let them know that there's some fun young lads who are watching it for the first time. And who they could watch it with. Mm-hmm. And I think that'll be fun. I can get us into plug stuff now.
Do it up, sir.
Okay. Wow, I'm getting kind of emotional that we're not going to talk about The Prisoner anymore.
That's okay.
Actually. But all right, here we go. So if you would like to contact us, there are a number of ways to do that. You can reach out via email, chatspod@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/chatspod. And that's where you can tweet us, you can DM us, you can follow us, all that stuff. You can also get involved in the chats community by going over to the subreddit, reddit.com/r/chatspod, which is lovingly created and maintained by the brothers at Infinite War, Nick and Pat. All of those instances of chatspod are spelled chatzpod. I should also mention on the subreddit, they are currently rewatching and listening to our very first chat season, where we watched Farscape called Scape Chats. So that's a fun little trip down memory lane for Alan and myself, and I think we had some fun stuff to say eventually about Farscape.
It's just briefly, I've been enjoying that a lot. They are, as of this recording, they've finished season two as well as our season two recap of that show, and it took us about two seasons to catch up to the release of the podcast. So right now we are exactly 7 days ahead of release, but back in the day we were about 7 months ahead of release.
Yeah, we were on such a wacky thing, and we were like putting them out on YouTube at first.
And
there were months in between episodes. What a wild time. Anyway, yeah, so that's all going on. If you'd like to support the show, which we are eternally grateful for, you can do so at patreon.com/chatspod. There are three different levels at which you can show your support. You can back at $1, which will get access to just like general posts and announcements, as well as if there are bonus series or one-off things that we want to put there. So a while ago, we just put out a bunch of random stuff for Christmas that I think is available to $1 and up.
Mm-hmm.
And then currently I'm doing a solo watch of The X-Files, which you can check out for $1. At $3, you can get our premium bonus content, Nummy Nummy Nummy. Three times a month, we'll give you three different things that you get to vote on. So we are wrapping up. We just wrapped up, actually, the month of May with a commentary of A Knight's Tale. By the time that this is coming out, our June content will have been decided and announced on the Patreon. It has yet to be decided and announced because we're recording a little ahead of the schedule here, but that'll be on the Patreon. You can check that out. And then $5 a month is just if you want to be like, hey, I'm the coolest patron in the world, although there's no cooler patron than my mom, who gives us the most money of anyone. Anyway, so that's that. Oh, you can also check out our Medium page, where we sometimes will do write-ups on episodes. Last week I did a write-up on Fallout and just my sort of overall thoughts on the Patrick McGoohan Prisoner.
Excellent piece right there.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Maybe the trick to getting me to write more articles is to watch Pride and Prejudice, because I won't be able to stop talking about it.
Yeah, I think I would love to read your Pride and Prejudice written coverage. Aww. That sounds delightful.
Aww.
So be on the lookout for that on the Medium. I think we have that linked pinned on our Twitter. I don't know how else you would find that. But that's how that goes. Anyway, that's all the plugs. That's where you can find us and contact us and all that stuff. Now let's get into the final phase of Chats, a television podcast, this episode, the way we do the episodes, which is where we share our chatsums, the little things we want to snack on between now and next time. So, Alan, what do you want the people snacking on? What's your chatsum?
Oh, boy, oh. Actually, both of my chatsums this week come from a listener, believe it or not.
Oh.
Because I was talking to this person and they were saying, I've been running out of chatsums because, you know, I like have the podcasts I listen to and I play the same games a lot. I haven't been branching out as much as I would like to. Sure. And, which is who's a regular contributor to the podcast and friend of the show, suggested two different podcasts to me that I think both Magellan and the listeners should check out. Okay. One is called The Hilarious World of Depression, which is a really, it's a mental health podcast, but it's also an interview podcast where they interview comedians, mostly comedians, musicians, and like the intersection of those two types of things. It's
Weird Al Yankovic.
Weird Al, yeah, exactly. They only interview Weird Al. it's very like impersonal, and you know, the episodes are. It's very like relaxing to listen to, because even though it can kind of be triggering for people to hear about like in-depth real descriptions of anxiety, depression, suicidal ideation and things like that, it's obviously got every content warning of that sort. The fact that they're talking to comedians makes it very approachable, and
yeah,
you know, comics are sad and also really funny. Those two things can and should often exist in tandem. So the recent episode that I had found, if people know, Magellan's a really big fan of the former Bare Naked Ladies head front man Stephen Page.
Heck yeah.
The most recent episode was, it's called Stephen Page Camouflages Songs About Depression, and it's kind of heavy, but it's also a lot of fun, because you get the fun of like an interview podcast with the realness of like talking to your friend at 2 a.m. about like, what does my brain want me to do with myself versus like, how do I function with this mental illness and all that.
Yeah. I haven't listened yet, but I'm really excited to listen to that.
It's so good. It might make you cry a little bit, especially if as a fan of him from a young age, but yeah. That's The Hilarious World of Depression. And the other podcast, which I only listened to a couple episodes of, but I really, really gravitated towards, is called What a Hell of a Way to Die. And it is basically another like chill conversational podcast, which, hey guys, that's every show almost is. But this one is like, what if these are two hardcore leftists who are also military veterans talking about the military. I think they're both also expats. One of them is an American living in the UK, and I think the other one's I don't think either of them are British, but yeah, they are. They're both veterans of the United States military, and they have a lot of thoughts on that with the like very online, very like hardcore leftist socialist people talking about like the military industrial complex, what it was like for them in basic training and getting into the military. And like, you think that wouldn't like make a really good like long-term podcast, but they always have something new to talk about. Even like, how does the military handle COVID-19 right now? Like, how are they, wow, like, how are,
that's interesting,
how are barracks testing people that are in close proximity like that all the time? Why are they even keeping people there at this time? Like, it's really good and fills a niche that I didn't even vaguely think I cared about, which is, to me, like, the perfect podcast.
Yeah, that's what you want out of a podcast, right?
Exactly. What about you, Magellan?
Cool. Well, I had three chatsums, and now you've actually reminded me of a fourth.
Oh, God.
That I have, so I'm going to go crazy for this grand finale of Prisoner Chats. The first, I don't think I've chatsumed this before. It's you just reminded me of it. It's a podcast called Know Your Enemy, and it was actually recommended to me by our roommate of the pod, Charlie, who we haven't seen in a while because he went home. But he's coming back. Actually, I didn't tell you this, but Charlie's coming back.
Whoa, wait, what? That's awesome.
Yeah, it's going to be cool.
So finally, Magellan will stop texting me at 2 a.m. like, baby, please, I miss humans. That's not true, and I would love it if Magellan texted me at 2 a.m.
Anyway, yeah, so he's coming back. But he really is a big fan of this podcast, Know Your Enemy. And the premise of it is the two hosts. It's another like super lefty podcast, if that's what you're into.
I am.
One of the hosts is a guy who grew up in a very left-wing household. Like his parents are union organizers or like might even be left-wing intellectuals or something. They're very, very left. Uh-huh. And then the other guy is someone who grew up conservative and was like a very staunch intellectual conservative and then went to graduate school for like political science or something and had an epiphany that actually
cracked.
Yeah. Right. The conservatism is all sorts of fucked up. And the podcast is about them talking about conservative thought and like the history of how it developed and like different books and thinkers and deconstructing those things. Really trying to get into the mind of like someone who believes this stuff. What are the things they think or what are the things that they do to better know the enemy, basically.
Oh.
Yeah, so it's cool. My other Chatsums, the next two are kind of related to each other. So I've been playing a lot of video games lately. Mm-hmm. And the most recent one that I'm getting into is an action RPG called The Outer Worlds. Which is created by Obsidian Entertainment, who also created, and this it's going to feel a lot like this game, they also created Fallout New Vegas, and they also created Knights of the Old Republic 2.
Oh.
Which is, yeah, right. They're great at making the sequels to great games. Anyway, The Outer Worlds is Fallout in space, and that is entirely what it is. So if you liked Fallout 3, Fallout New Vegas, I haven't played Fallout 4, but I'm assuming it's similar. If you like those games and you want another one that's got a similar vibe, similar systems, but like a little bit different, and it's you're hopping between planets and stuff, The Outer Worlds is a perfectly good example of that. I think there are some moments where it can feel a little bit slight at times, in comparison to Fallout, because those games are pretty vast and open canvases in a way that this game is a little more, you're a little more like directed mm-hmm. in this game, I think. But, and also the comedy, I think, is a little more one note than in Fallout. Because in this, it's sort of like corporations are bad, huh? But we're all pretending like they're good. Fallout does other types of dystopia jokes. But, I really like it so far, and I think it's good.
I played, I played up to when you get the ship in that game, and I definitely felt that sort of like railroading, or like these choices are super binary, and this all kind of falls under the umbrella of like capitalism bad, which like yes, but it didn't feel that critical. But also at the end of the day, like putting that kind of storyline into a game, especially on the limited budget and weird development history of most Obsidian titles, is really ambitious and great. And I mean, it, like you said, it satisfies a niche that you're not getting too many other places right now.
Right. Yeah. So I recommend it. I'm having a lot of fun playing it.
Great.
And those sort of narrative critiques I'm just putting in there for, it was a sort of like buyer beware stamp on it. Mm-hmm. And then in relation to that, I was looking for Outer Worlds videos and I stumbled across this series of videos that IGN has done where they have developers of video games sit down and react to people speedrunning their games.
Yeah. Awesome.
It's really fun. The Outer Worlds one, they speedrun it in 12 minutes. And there's stuff like, oh my God, you can jump over that wall? I had no idea you could jump over that. Why is he stealing that disguise? I don't understand. And then the speedrunner uses that disguise to like just walk through the final level, basically.
King. Love it.
Stuff like that. There's one for Doom Eternal where the speedrunner does like really wild exploity stuff to clip through the whole world, and they're like, okay, well I guess we need to put an unskippable cutscene in the sky now. Stuff like that. It's fun. So I recommend those. And then the last Chatsum, as we leave you and leave the prisoner, handing off the torch, essentially. Yeah, we're trying to be good sports here. If you are interested in further prisoner coverage, if you want to hear different perspectives on the prisoner, If you want to sit with the prisoner for another few months, we are done with it. But we know of another podcast who recently started to cover the prisoner. They're kind of hard to find right now because they just started. At least I was having trouble finding a feed for them. But they were called Totally Reprise because they were covering Totally Spies. And now they're called The Repriseiner because they're covering the prisoner. And they're doing one episode a week. I was listening to the beginning of their first episode today. And if you want more prisoner stuff, I say go check them out.
Yeah. Shout outs to them. Different style, but same fun coverage. Lots of good comedy with them and a great dynamic, I think.
Yeah.
I support it 100%. Other endeavors similar to ours. Cool. Well, Magellan.
Yes, Alan.
Thank you, as always, more than ever, for being the rock to my hard place.
Oh, wait.
What's up?
I forgot the stupid thing in the 2009 reboot, which is they put the penny farthing hanging from the ceiling in the sex club.
I didn't even notice it. You told me about it and I forgot to look for it.
Yeah, it's when Two walks in and he's walking around. And he like looks up and there's a penny farthing hanging from the ceiling.
That's a criminal crime.
Yeah, it's a criminal crime. It's also a criminal crime that they say be seeing you in the show, but they don't do the hand motion.
They don't do the hand motion. Oh! Yeah.
Which is why I think that we should do that with the hand motion right now.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Prisoner Chats. Be seeing you.
Be seeing you.